Hey, and welcome to the 25th episode of Forecast, a show about climate science and climate scientists. I'm Mike White, Nature's editor for climate science. If you're a new listener, what I usually do in the show is to talk to climate scientists about their background, the story of how they got to be where they are now, and then about the science that they're doing. So really, we're trying to understand who climate scientists are and how they do the work that they're doing. Over the past few episodes, you may have heard me talking about whether or not we should be trying to limit global warming to 1.5 Celsius as opposed to 2.0, which was the previous politically agreed upon threshold. And I've had takes on this from people like Reto Kanuti and Gabby Hegerl, and most recently Ed Hawkins. But in a lot of ways, the issues that surround us are related to the communication of climate science relative to the cost of doing so, the cost of not doing so, and how to communicate this to a broader audience. So I thought that it might be interesting to talk to somebody who comes more from the communication background than from the pure science background. And for that, we turn to Susan Joy Hassel, who's made a career out of climate communication. I met Susan in 1995 at the Aspen Global Change Institute when I was very new into grad school and attending an extended workshop in land cover detection from satellite remote sensing. And I was just absolutely terrified. And I actually don't remember meeting Susan at the time, nor she me, I think, but we ran into each other a few years later at a discourse mentoring workshop for PhD students and a new postdoc. So connected there, and I've seen her at AGU and seen a lot of her work in terms of public outreach. So essentially what she does is try to communicate the best ways to get across climate science to a broader audience. She works with scientists directly. She has foundation support. She does workshops, has done TED Talks, written for HBO, written for the National Climate Assessment, so has this incredibly broad range of expertise in how to do that. Susan and I talk a lot about how to use specific wording to get across ideas in climate science, which are easily misconstrued by the broader public, and then specifically how to reframe issues like 1.5 versus 2.0 away from the numerical constructs and to use things like analogies and stories and to give people hope, a sense of urgency, and a sense that choices actually matter. If these ideas strike a chord with you, you can also check out Susan's website, climatecommunication.org, which is just a veritable cornucopia of resources and ideas about how to communicate climate science. Also, most of the people who are getting their PhDs now or have just gotten their PhDs are not going to end up in a tenure-track position. And Susan's story, I think, is a powerful example of how you can build your own identity and your own career pursuing your strengths and your own interests. Otherwise, for me, I completed the 2016 edition of Death Ride, which is a bike ride of 129 miles and 15,000 feet of climbing. It was a huge accomplishment for me, and I have to say I was partially inspired to do that by my interview with Peter Sellers, which is available in the Forecast archives. With that, on to the show. Susan Joy Hassel from Climate Communication. Thank you for coming on the show today, Susan.
My pleasure.
You have an interesting connection with one of the most famous people in the history of climate science, Stephen Schneider. You and Stephen were in school together back in your hometown or home area of Long Island. Is that right?
Yeah, we both went to Lawrence High School. He was there a few years before I. He used to get mad at me for pointing that out to people. But yeah, he was a good colleague and friend, and we all miss him, of course.
What was your life like growing up in Long Island? What were your parents like?
You know, I was born into a multi-generational situation, a brick tenement in Brooklyn where we lived four generations together. That was great. Very close family and moved out to Long Island and had sort of a suburban upbringing, but very close to New York City, so had all of those benefits.
When did you move out to Long Island from Brooklyn?
Oh, I was probably 5 or 6 years old.
Did the whole family move out, all four generations, or just the... Your
no,
immediate family.
Just my immediate family. The others stayed in Brooklyn and the family business stayed in Brooklyn. The family business was a furniture store. My grandfather was a poet, so the furniture store was called Hassel's Furniture, and the slogan that my grandfather wrote was, "Turn your homes into castles with furniture from Hassel's."
That's great. So I can kind of see how that background would lead into what you're doing now, which is largely science communication, having a four-generation family in the same location and these tight connections. Yeah, you must have had a lively discussion going at all times growing up.
Yes, and in multiple languages.
Your grandparents were immigrants?
Yeah, my great-grandparents were immigrants and spoke Yiddish. So yeah, it was always interesting. And so translation has always been an interest of mine. And people used to say at the Aspen Global Change Institute that I was like a simultaneous translator at the UN. It was science in, English out.
So then moving on into college, you also focused on communication when you were at Syracuse. Was that a clear choice for you, or did you explore other options both in high school and in college?
It's interesting. My parents always thought that I was a very good communicator and pushed me in that direction. And I was interested in it. I was interested in radio and television, broadcast journalism, but I really didn't like television and still don't. But I also understand that it's a very important medium. And I became really enamored with film when I started out in school and ended up as a film major. But I studied public communication and public affairs. I did a little work at a public radio station in Syracuse, public affairs reporting. I really like being able to help people understand things that they might not otherwise understand. And I'm sort of like a sponge. I love information. I love to absorb large amounts of complex information and then synthesize it and clarify it and express it to other people in a way that's simple and clear and effective. So that seems to be my natural talent. Everybody's got something, and that seems to be mine.
How should I understand the way in which climate science communication can work well or not in the media that you just mentioned, which would be radio, film, and television?
I think we know certain things about communication of any kind. One of the things we know is that what works are simple, clear messages repeated often by a variety of trusted sources. And so when we have that, it's good. We know another thing is that stories are very important in communicating. That scientists like to think that the facts will speak for themselves, but they don't. You have to speak for them. And the way you do that is through stories. People connect emotionally to stories. And so when you see filmmaking or television, like the Years of Living Dangerously series, it's a series of stories that build in the information about climate change. And that's effective.
You spent a lot of time living in Aspen, Colorado, and working at the Aspen Global Change Institute. I think we crossed paths in 1995 when there was a workshop there in Landcover.
Yep.
But it seems like part of what the Aspen Global Change Institute was trying to do was to have intensive summer workshops and then work with someone like yourself to try and develop a more digestible storyline from that. Can you talk about how you learned about the process of developing stories from a bunch of conehead scientists down to a shorter, broadly accessible document?
I think that's really where my natural talent for doing exactly that comes in. Of course, for those reports, I worked very closely with the chairs of each meeting who had a theme in mind and invited people from across a broad range of disciplines in both the physical but also the social sciences. And at first, these people were not used to talking to each other. You know, atmospheric chemists are used to talking to other atmospheric chemists. They don't, you know, spend that much time talking to oceanographers, and they certainly don't talk to demographers or economists. And so we brought all those kinds of people together to work on particular issues in global change, and it was always fascinating. People would give these hour-long technical talks, and then I'd be in the position of trying to write a one-page plain language summary, which was not easy, but it was a wonderful education for me, just unmatched, I think. And I spent a lot of time asking questions, trying to understand what exactly they were saying and why it mattered. The so what question is one I'm constantly asking scientists when they talk about their work and what they've found. And so putting it all together and having it mean something to someone outside of that field is just exactly the kind of thing I love to do. I actually did it in the energy field for a little while before I started at the Aspen Global Change Institute. I used to write a one-page weekly news brief for people in the energy arena. And so I would read lots of publications, everything from the Oil and Gas Journal to the Nuclear News to everything that was going on with regulation of energy and efficiency. And I would pick the maybe 10 stories a week that I felt were strategically important, and I would summarize each one in a paragraph. And I put out this 4-page newsletter, and people who didn't have time to spend their whole week reading about this stuff could get that kind of information. And so that's the kind of thing I really enjoyed doing. And boy, you sure get an education while you're doing it.
How do you go from this incredibly complicated material in some cases, like atmospheric chemistry, for example, and get the scientists to explain it to you in a way that can be brought into a one-page summary or one-paragraph summary even?
I think it's about asking the right questions, and I also think it's about having a broad perspective. So I have a really broad perspective on climate change and on global change because I do keep up with the science across a very wide range of things. So everything from the atmospheric chemistry through to the impacts through to solutions, and also the psychology and the communication and all of that science. Most of the time when you're talking to a scientist that has focused on one small piece of that story, they're often asked questions that they haven't really thought much about, and they can't really answer because they say, well, that's not my area. But I'm a broad generalist, so I have a very different perspective, and I would ask questions from that perspective, and I would find that most of the time we were able to find some common ground and come up with something that was useful.
The issues that you talked about in terms of communication among fields is just an epidemic problem, even in disciplinary meetings. I was at a meeting on ocean turbulence a few years ago, and it was half observationalists and half theoreticians, and I was pretty lost during the theoretical talks, and I at one point turned to somebody from the observational side and I said, I don't really understand this talk. Can you tell me what's going on? And this person said, no, I don't know what's going on either. And so, I mean, even within relatively narrow fields, this is an issue. But then when you bring together people from demography or politics into the equation, the meetings can go completely haywire and go down separate pathways of miscommunication. Have you found over the years that there are ways to design meetings or interactions that make this process go better?
The conversation has to be at a level where everybody can participate. Obviously, people have to use language that's common language and, you know, not fall back on their jargon. And one of my favorite subjects is these terms that mean different things. And even within the scientific field, you find terms, whether they're acronyms or jargon, that mean different things, even to different scientists.
Right.
Everybody's got to agree to try and speak common language and to talk about the areas where these things intersect. And where the science in its depth really matters to the subject, then it falls to the subject matter expert to explain it to everybody else in a language they can understand. And while there is always complexity, I find that the basic story in many cases is really pretty straightforward. And I think that's true of climate change in general, and I think it's also true of some of the more specifics. One of the things I tell scientists often is, so pretend you're talking to your Aunt Mabel, or, you know, somebody who just doesn't know much about this. How would you explain it to her?
I was at a recent meeting on the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation in Boulder, which is a fascinating topic. And the overall goal was to try and bridge modern observations to the paleoclimate record. Mm-hmm. But at the last day, at the last discussion section, York Schaefer raised the point that he didn't actually think that they were all talking about the same thing when they talked about the AMOC. And it was the kind of discussion that probably would have been better placed at the beginning to, as you say, get everyone on the same page. Do you think that this is sort of just incumbent on the meeting organizers to try and put these communication issues at the forefront? And if so, what's the best way to facilitate that process? Is it through broad plenary talks or having an immediate discussion about the sort of vocabulary and framing issues?
Yeah, I think you should have that kind of conversation right up front. I'm a firm believer that you should always start everything with communication, that a communication perspective has to be built in right from the beginning, whether it's at a meeting or a project that you're going to work on, and that so often it's tagged on at the end, and that's not the best place for it, because as you say, this would have been more fruitful if it was at the beginning. So I recently was at a National Academy meeting on the so-called hiatus, which is another word we can talk about, because it, you know, is not a hiatus. It never should have been called a hiatus. Hiatus is a break in the pattern. And in fact, we know that the pattern has always been sort of a stair step, and we don't expect it to go up in a straight line, so that when natural variability is moving against the long-term upward trend, you get a flat period. And when natural variability is moving in the same direction as the upward trend, you get an upward part of the trend. So it's sort of like a wavy staircase. To call a flat period, a relatively flat period, a hiatus is really not a good language choice, because it implies that it's stopped, that something has paused, that there's been a break in the pattern, and in fact, it hasn't been. So they asked me to give a little talk at the beginning to frame some of this, and to talk about some of the language issues. And everybody shook their head and agreed with me. And then they kept on calling it the hiatus throughout the whole rest of the meeting. They also had me give another little talk at the end, and sort of bookending it with some of the communication issues was a good idea. But I really agree with what you said, that having some of that laid out right up front to define our terms. What are we really talking about here? And do we all mean the same thing when we say AMOC or THC, which is one of these great things that means different things, right? Thermohaline circulation to scientists, but it's the active ingredient in marijuana to many other people. So yeah, I think that setting it up properly with the communication perspective right from the start is an important piece of that.
One meeting format that I participated in a couple of years ago was a horizon scan, in which the broader community, in this case, it was Antarctic science, sends in this gigantic list of questions that they think should be the topics for the next 10, 20, 30 years. So looking down the horizon, independent of technological and funding constraints. And then a subset of that group gets together, break out into smaller groups, and discuss the questions and go through a pyramid-shaped voting exercise where the groups get bigger and bigger and the number of questions get smaller and smaller until at the end, the community votes for the top 10 or however many questions they previously agreed to vote on. The process itself was fantastic because you have an endpoint that you know everyone is going towards, and people have buy-in to stay for the entire meeting and to participate. So even if you're an introvert, you can still vote. You still have to vote, in fact, even if you're not comfortable talking in group environments. I thought it was just a great way to have an intense but focused and clearly pinpointed debate on a topic that had then an outcome that would be influential going forward for the field. Are there other formats in terms of meetings, discussions, perhaps through the national academies that you think have worked well like this? And then formats that you think have had their chance and haven't worked well?
I always think more interactive types of things work particularly well. Shorter talks with more chance for interaction and questions and answers, I think. Because effective communication is really more of a conversation than it is a lecture. That's generally my preference, is for more engagement and then the kind of group decision making maybe that you're talking about.
You are now in the business of science engagement. You went from the Aspen Global Change Institute. You had some fellowships, for example, I think at NCAR, but now are running your own company called Climate Communication. Can you talk about the progression from the AGCI through your other placements and then finally to where you are now? How did that take place and what motivated you to do that?
Sitting in the back of the room at Aspen Global Change Institute sessions, taking notes, writing pieces, it became clear that I seemed to have a knack for communicating complex scientific things in plain language in a way that would be effective. And so it was from that seat that I was drafted to be the senior science writer on the first National Climate Assessment. This was back in the 90s. So many of the, you know, leaders of the field that used to attend these meetings knew of the work that I was doing, and they asked me if I could serve in that role. They knew that they didn't just need any science writer. They needed someone who was really steeped in the science of climate change and had the relationships with the scientists and could really help them with this project. So I started working on the first National Climate Assessment, and I just never went back. You know, that I just went out on my own, and people would ask me to work on these various projects, and I went from one to another. After that, I did the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment, where I worked for 4 years with scientists from across the Arctic region. And after that, HBO asked me to do a 1-hour documentary on climate change, which was called Too Hot Not to Handle. So I was the writer on that. And then it was just one project after another. And you know, I worked on so many of these assessments. I learned so much. I did the next two national climate assessments as well, including the most recent one. Then it occurred to me that in the midst of all this, I started doing some other things because my scientist colleagues were asking for my help in becoming more effective communicators. So I started advising them individually and then also doing workshops for scientists on how to communicate more effectively about climate change and helping them with other things, you know, writing op-eds or things that were important to them that they wanted to get right. And eventually it occurred to me that rather than just work for these individual projects that could afford to pay for my expertise, that it would be really great to have some foundation funding to be able to offer my expertise to the community without them having to pay for it. Because so many of the calls I got were from scientists saying, this is happening right now, and I need your help today. I've got to go testify on Capitol Hill tomorrow. How are you going to monetize that?
Yeah, so they wouldn't have a funding mechanism in place to deal with that really exigent issue.
Right. And so I was able to raise some foundation funds, and I have been for the last 5 years or so, maybe a little more, to do that. And I offer all kinds of help to people across the field. I also help journalists because they're often looking for the right people to talk to on a particular issue. And so what I do for them is act as sort of an index source, they call it. I give them a lot of background information on a topic to bring them up to speed. And then I tell them who are the best people on any given topic for them to call and talk to. Not only the best scientists doing some of the best work, but people who can communicate to them in a language that they can understand. So I work with journalists. I work with scientists. I help others with these kinds of climate communication training issues, people working in other nonprofits and so on. So it was a thing that I can't say I had a plan to do this. It evolved out of my natural talent for doing what I do, and also my passion, really, for feeling that, boy, this science is so solid and so important and so good and so fascinating. And people don't know it. They don't know what we know. And so at first I thought, well, if we could just get everybody to know what we know, then we'll solve this problem. Big mistake, because of course I later realized that this was not an information deficit problem. This was much more of sort of a tribalistic ideological divide problem, and a problem of a disinformation campaign and all kinds of other things that were coming into play, you know, from psychology to ideology to just plain black hats that were out to confuse the public intentionally. As I learned about all these things, one of the things I've come to do is to help the scientific community understand some of that stuff. What are they up against when they talk about this stuff to an audience? What else is going on? If they get a lot of skeptical questions, is it because the people don't understand the science, or is there something else going on? And might there be a different way for them to approach talking about it? So that's sort of been the progression. It's been fascinating, and I never could have planned it.
Of course, scientists are traditionally in the business of producing and discussing knowledge, which you've just described isn't necessarily what needs to get across in order to move forward on climate change adaptation or mitigation. What is the general process like when you are approached by someone who has that problem? I'm going to talk to Congress tomorrow. How do I talk to them about extreme heat waves or extreme flooding? What is your triaging process when you're dealing with someone in that situation?
I'm faced with that quite often. And I do try and help them to talk about the science in a way that other people will understand it and care about it. That has to do with crafting some simple, clear, sticky messages that are story-based, to use imagery and metaphor and get across the information in a way that will be heard, but then also to put it into context for people. For example, I was helping a scientist recently. He'd been working on sea level rise and some of the new findings out of West Antarctica that showed that we might be faced with much larger sea level rise sooner than we thought, and that a certain amount of this was basically looked like it was now in the pipeline and that there was little we could do about it. One of the things I was telling him, I was helping him understand how to talk about that and how to frame that in a way that people could understand. So for example, go back 10 years and a lot of meltwater was starting to come off of Greenland, and scientists were starting to use these numbers to tell people how much water, and they knew what that meant, but the people they were talking to had absolutely no context for these gigantic numbers. You know, whether it was an acre feet or whatever it was, we figured out at that time that the amount of water coming off Greenland that year was as much water as the entire city of Los Angeles used for all purposes in an entire year. So that's the kind of context that you have to give people. That's a way of talking about numbers and doing the math in a way that makes some sense to people and that they can understand.
You shouldn't use words like gigatons or cubic kilometers. Words
no.
Like this.
Well, and if you do, you better say what it means. So, for example, Alaska's glaciers lost 75 gigatons or billion tons of ice last year. So when President Obama was in Alaska, he wanted to talk about that. And he wanted to put that into context for people. So he said, you know, let me put this into context. 1 gigaton of ice would be a block of ice that would cover the entire National Mall in Washington, from Congress all the way to the Lincoln Memorial, and 4 times as tall as the Washington Monument. That's 1 gigaton. Now imagine 75 of those. That's how much water Alaska's glaciers lost each year. You know, that's a big deal. That's the kind of way of doing the math. You know, because just the numbers by themselves just numb people. Numbers numb. That's the shorthand. Let me go back for a second. What I wanted to go a little bit further on is this question about how then I advised the scientists to talk about the issue of sea level rise and the, quote, inevitability of a certain amount of sea level rise and the really bad news that we'd gotten from this recent research, because I had just gotten done telling him that you really want to be positive, that you really want to be hopeful, because people need hope. If people feel in despair, it makes them feel passive, and it makes them not want to do anything and feel like they can't do anything. It makes them want to just pull the covers over their head. But if people feel hopeful, then they're more inclined to take action. He said, well, what can I possibly say in a situation like this? And I said, well, I would say a couple of things, or a couple of important themes. One of them is choice. The choice that we face is between a little more sea level rise and a lot more sea level rise. And that depends on what our emissions are and how quickly we act. You know, the difference between sea level rise at 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial and between 2 degrees Celsius pre-industrial could be double. We could see twice as much sea level rise at 2 degrees. So that's a big difference. So choice, we face a choice. The future's in our hands. Another thing I told him was urgency is a really important theme. There are tipping points in the system, and we don't know exactly where they are, but we know that the harder we push the system, the more of those thresholds will cross. So there's an urgency to acting, and we have to do as much as we can, as fast as we can, to avoid as much of this future change as possible. To me, when you're talking about a scientific finding, like something's happening in this sector of West Antarctica, you can really numb people by just talking about the numbers and the facts, but if you put it into context for them of what this means in terms of choice and urgency, I think that's a much more effective way to get them to hear what you have to say.
When you're trying to develop this kind of advice for climate scientists, are you working with focus groups? Are you working through trial and error, or are you working with psychologists in terms of how best to frame the issues?
I don't do focus groups personally, but I read the findings from people who do. I have lots of colleagues who do research in this area, and some of it is cognitive psychology, some of it is polling. There's a lot of research on what makes people think the way they do, what kinds of emotions are associated with action, for example. And we know that hope is one of those emotions that's associated with action. And worry is an emotion that's associated with action. But fear is not, and despair is not. So you want people to be worried. If they're not worried about this, I think they don't really understand what's going on. But you don't want to push them so far that they go all the way to fear, because then they get paralyzed and they go to despair. How do you get people to worry without being afraid? I feel like the best thing is hope, providing hope. If you are worried about something, but you feel like there's something you can do about it, then you're more likely not to fall into despair, and you're more likely to feel activated. So Henry Ford said, whether you think you can or you think you can't, you're right. Point being, you got to believe that you can. You got to believe that it's possible, or you're not even going to try.
What are the main axes for hope, do you think, right now? Let's talk about America in particular. I think that the ones that come to mind for me are mitigation, and then you have adaptation, which would be the strategies to make society more resilient to what is coming down the road anyway. Do you find that discussions on one or the other tend to be more productive in terms of generating hope?
Well, it depends totally on your audience. There are some audiences who don't even accept the science of climate change. So for them, talking about reducing emissions, if they don't even believe those emissions are the cause, may not be the first line of discussion. However, one of the things we know is that the same actions that we take to minimize climate change also have other effects. And those very positive effects can be motivating even if people don't accept the science of climate change. So the jargon, scientists call them co-benefits, but I never use that word because it's jargon and people don't know what it means. I think it sounds like something that has to do with health insurance. But I always talk about the multiple benefits of the actions that we can take on climate change. And so there's research on this. Bain et al. In Nature Climate Change published a piece about how actions to reduce climate change, those multiple benefits that they have, motivate people. They did this research all around the world, and they found that people who didn't even accept the science of climate change were just as motivated by those multiple benefits as people who did accept the science of climate change. So talking about cleaner air, talking about economic development and scientific development and creating healthier communities, all of those things are things that everyone can agree on. That's a reason for hope. I think things like the price of solar and wind plummeting and the amount of deployment of solar and wind recently skyrocketing are reasons for hope. We're already seeing these things happen. We have the technologies. We know what to do. We just need to deploy them faster. There are a lot of reasons for hope. The fact that the Pope is engaged and that he's making the moral case for climate change. The fact that all the nations of the world agreed in Paris to begin to decarbonize. I talked a little bit about storytelling. And we have to ask ourselves, what story are we telling? Are we telling the story of Chicken Little, the sky is falling? Or are we telling the story of the little engine that could? I think I can, I think I can. And I think if we start trying to shift away from the Chicken Little story and more to the little engine that could story, then we'll be doing a better job of helping people understand that we actually can do something about this. Another piece of research suggests that people are more motivated when they feel like we're already on our way, rather than feeling like we're starting from scratch. And so here's how they did this research. You know those customer loyalty cards, like if you go to a car wash and you get 10 punches, you get a free car wash.
Sure.
Okay, so half the people in the study got that card. The other people in the study got a card where they had to get 12 punches to get a free car wash, but they gave them 2 free ones to give them a head start.
I can see where this is going.
You can see where this is going, right? They both needed the same amount, but look what happened. The people who got the 2 free punches, who got the head start, they were twice as likely to complete the task, and they got there faster. 34% of them finished as opposed to 17% of the people who got the one that they needed 10 punches. So this is one of those nudges. This is one of those small changes that we can make that we know that psychologically people feel like, all right, we're already on our way. We can do this. So to bring it back to climate change, I never say, oh, we have to remake the entire world's energy system from scratch. How will we ever get there?
Yeah.
No, I say, you know that of all the electricity, that new generation that came online last year, most of it was renewable. More than half was renewable globally, and it was more than 70% in the United States. So we're doing this. You know, this is something that's underway, and we just need to move faster and do as much as we can as fast as we can.
The narrative that you hear more commonly, I think, is the rate at which China is building new coal-fired power plants, but that's actually not the broader picture.
It's not. And in fact, China is taking a lot of actions. China's taking a lot of those coal plants off the drawing board. China has actually been using less coal in recent years. And they're the largest producer of renewable energy equipment. They're scaling up and they're selling that equipment around the world. They're using it at home. And so China is actually a pretty good news story, I think, amazingly. I think India is actually a little scarier. That's a place where we're probably looking at continuing increase in emissions over the years to come, unless something very strong is done to change that picture.
You talked a lot about the need to bring hope into discussions about what to do to move the debate forward. But you've also done a lot of work and provided a lot of advice on what not to do, what not to say. And you have a list or a collection of specific terms that you feel have been especially unhelpful in climate change discussions. What are some of those terms and why do they not work well?
I'm a firm believer that words matter. And there are a whole bunch of reasons why they matter. There are certain words that trigger psychological issues. So, for example, if you hear somebody say, the world is warming and it's our fault, where to blame.
So you feel guilty right away.
You feel guilty right away. And some people will get defensive and go right to denial. And guilt is one of those emotions that's associated with passivity. When we feel guilty, we are passive. We don't feel like acting. So that's not good. I never say fault or blame. Instead, I say responsibility.
Yeah.
The world's warming. We're the cause. It's our responsibility. Responsibility is a positive word, right? That's the kind of people we are. We take responsibility for our actions.
Well, what about also saying things like the consequence of industrialization has been that we've had a doubling in lifespan, a vast increase for much of the industrialized world. We're living much, much more luxurious and enjoyable lives, but there's a cost to that. And we have a responsibility to try and reduce that cost, or some kind of line that acknowledges the benefits that have come about from industrialization.
Yeah, I think that's fine. I'm just making the point that in the very short phrase that you often hear, we want to be pretty careful about what words we choose, because they really do matter. You know, another one of those words is the word inevitable. I often hear scientists say, talking, and even in the titles of their papers, is the word inevitable. Well, inevitable means to people, there's nothing we can do about it.
So
this is going to happen no matter what we do. So why bother? And so I never say that. I think the better frame is choice. What's the choice we face between a little more warming and a lot more warming, between a little more sea level and a lot more sea level rise? That's the kind of word choice that I think we want to be pretty careful about. Then there are words that trigger ideological responses. So regulate, restrict, cut, conserve, tax. You can already see that somebody who is on the conservative side of things might say, wow, that doesn't sound very good to me. But if you talk about innovation and entrepreneurship and competition, right, competing in the global clean energy economy and, you know, exceptionalism, then that's a much better way to frame the solution space, and you might get a different response. We also have a problem with words that frame the problem as abstract and distant. People talk about saving the planet. It's not really about saving the planet.
The planet's going to be fine.
The planet's going to be fine, right? This is about the conditions necessary for human life. This is happening here and now in our own backyards. It's affecting us, intensifying wildfires, burning more acres, longer, deeper droughts, heavier downpours, longer, more intense heat waves. This is affecting us. We should talk about it that way instead of framing it as abstract and distant in time and space. Now, another one of the things that I'm sort of famous for is these words that mean different things to scientists than they do to the public. Now, this is even worse than jargon. Now, jargon's bad enough. And, you know, when scientists say anthropogenic, I always say, you know, people don't know what that means. Just say human caused. But now these other words, they're even worse than jargon.
Why don't you give me a quiz? I'll try and guess what the public thinks the word means.
Oh, okay, good. So how about the word aerosol?
Like spray cans for hair.
Exactly. The public thinks an aerosol is a spray can, but scientists talk about aerosols. They mean these tiny particles in the atmosphere. So when you're talking to the public, say tiny particles. Don't say aerosols.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, how about the word enhance?
Make bigger?
Right. So to scientists, enhance means to increase, to make bigger. But to the public,
it means make better.
It means to make better,
as
enhance your appearance, right? So when you talk about the enhanced greenhouse effect, oh, good, new and improved.
Sounds awesome.
Enhanced hurricane activity, oh, good. So instead of enhance, I say, why don't you just use intensify?
Yeah.
Right? So there are so many of these words. How about the word theory?
Theory, probably maybe something that you don't really know, but you have an idea about it.
Right. So to the public, a theory is just a hunch or a guess. Oh, that's just some theory. But to scientists, a theory is something that's very well established in science, right? Like the theory of gravity, right? But, you know, to the public, when you say, oh, global warming is only a theory, they think it's only a hunch or a guess. So this is really a problem. Here's another one. Scientists are often talking about error, standard error, or errors, or so forth, right? So what do you think the word error means to the public?
Mistake.
Wrong. It just means wrong or a mistake, exactly.
Yeah.
So you want to be careful when you're talking about errors or error bars. You know, I always say when I retire, I'm going to open a tavern for scientists. I'm going to call it the error bar. Yeah, there are so many of these words. I have 150 of these words now that mean entirely different things to scientists than they do to the public. How about the word bias?
I think bias would mean that you have an inherent, almost ideological belief in one side of something or other.
Exactly. That's what the public thinks it means. Oh, you're biased. But when scientists talk about bias, they talk about the data being biased. That's not what they mean at all, of course.
Yeah, they mean a systematic error or a systematic difference between observations and reality.
Exactly. So when the people hear scientists talking about data bias, oh, see, I knew they were biased.
Yeah.
So we have to be really careful about these words because they really do mean different things. And so I wrote an article in EOS some years ago, the AGU publication, that lays out a bunch of these. And then I wrote another article with Richard Somerville a few years later in Physics Today, where we made a table of some of these words. And we gave the scientific use, the public meaning, and then some better choices. And you can download those at my website, climatecommunication.org. We have a section of resources, and one of them is articles. And so you can download those, and everybody can have those. And then if anybody wants my full list of 150 words, they can email me, and I'll be happy to share that as well. I think once you get the hang of this and you realize what it's about, you can start to anticipate what some of these are. And a lot of scientists have told me that this has been really helpful to them. I also did a TEDx talk recently in which I talked some about these words and other ways in which language is important and some of these other issues around communication that I think are so critical. And that's also at my website, climatecommunication.org.
That's a great TED talk, by the way, for people who are interested.
Thanks.
A couple of terms that I've seen in scientific literature, but also in communication that I kind of have a problem with, for example, is the term irreversible climate change.
Yep.
First of all, just scientifically, nothing is irreversible in the climate system. I mean, the range of variability we know from the paleo record is that the system is going to go back and forth between these vastly different states with great rapidity in some cases. How do you feel? Do you feel that like irreversible is another word that could be reframed in a better way?
Oh, absolutely. This is what I was talking about choice. I would never use the word irreversible. I mean, for two reasons. One, as you say, it all depends on time scale. For another, I just think when you say irreversible, people think there's nothing we can do about it. So why even bother? I wouldn't use the word irreversible climate change. I prefer to talk about how much is already baked in and how much we can avoid. You know, another great example of this is that when we talk about the 1.5 limit on temperature above pre-industrial, people will use the term negative emissions. Well, we'll need negative emissions. Well, negative and positive are two of those words that I say mean different things because to the public, negative means bad, right? So negative emissions are bad emissions. What you really are talking about is drawing down carbon dioxide, right? Why not just say drawing down or removing heat-trapping gases from the atmosphere? Why do we say negative emissions? It's a ridiculous term for public usage.
But not for necessarily scientific usage. So I'm curious about your advice to people about these kinds of word choices in the scientific literature versus in public communication. Do you think that we should have a movement towards more plain language in scientific papers themselves?
If you're pretty sure that only other scientists are reading what you're writing, then it's fine. Scientists use these terms just like they use jargon as a shorthand. I mean, I don't think it takes any more words to say draw down or remove gases than negative emissions, but I understand why they use these terms amongst themselves. The problem is then when reporters read their papers or their press releases and then they report that to the public, then you have this problem. I think if you're really sure you're only among colleagues, then fine, use that language.
Yeah.
But when you're talking to reporters or you're talking to the public, you do have to be much more aware of the language that you're using. I mean, you can see where this could become a problem. Two of my other favorites are, well, one, of course, is positive feedback. Right. People know that in life, a positive feedback is a good thing. Right. They do a good job at work. They get positive feedback. But in the climate system, of course, positive feedback is a vicious cycle. It's a bad thing. But you can't blame someone for mistaking that because it means the opposite of what they would expect it to mean.
Yeah.
So I mentioned when President Obama was in Alaska. Well, when he was there, he was talking about how warming was triggering more melting, more fires, more thawing of the permafrost. And he said, it's a negative feedback loop, a cycle where warming's leading to more warming. We don't want to be a part of that. So obviously, from a scientific point of view, he got that wrong. It's a positive feedback loop, as the way scientists would put it.
Yeah, yeah.
But you can't blame him for getting it wrong because
no, absolutely not.
He's right. The way that the public thinks about negative is bad. And so, like, if we have a positive economic trend, that's a good trend. You know, a negative economic trend means it's a bad thing. So, of course, he said it's a negative feedback loop. We just want to be kind of careful about stuff like that. People talk about the trend in temperature and they call it a positive trend. Not so much, right? That means it's getting hotter. It's not positive. We really have to be more thoughtful about those kinds of words.
One issue that's at the forefront of a lot of submissions to Nature and Nature branded journals right now in climate science is the issue that you've raised a few times, the idea of having a global warming threshold of only 1.5 degrees Celsius as opposed to 2.0, which had been the previous politically agreed upon threshold that we should try and stay below. There's been kind of a range of opinions about how we should be talking about this in terms of, first of all, just its feasibility. It's difficult to imagine doing this without drawing down CO2 as opposed to letting it kind of keep on going as it is. And there's opinions that it's essentially impossible to do this. So why are we even talking about this? Other people have made the argument that, well, you know, it's the role of scientists to just engage in these scenarios and to just explore the technical possibility without getting into the political and economic ramifications of doing something like this. When you see this kind of a seismic shift going on in something like 1.5 versus 2.0, what are the issues that come to mind in terms of how to communicate this within the scientific community and then externally to the broader public?
By talking about 1.5 degrees C as an aspirational target, we're acknowledging that serious harm will come from warming above that level. And so that's good. There's certainly convincing scientific evidence and a rationale for targeting well below 2 and aspiring to 1.5. And a lot of that has to do with the thresholds and the tipping points that we could cross. And when you see what's already going on now, and we haven't even gotten to 1.5,
right,
and we're losing coral reefs, you know, by the droves, and we've got significant sea level rise and more that we're committed to, and we're seeing what's going on with extreme weather being exacerbated, some types of extreme weather, you can certainly see why this discussion is important. And the details of what that means, of what 1.5 means, are crucial for scientists and the policymakers involved in these negotiations. But as far as communication with the general public, I don't think talking about either 1.5 or 2 is effective. First of all, they're abstractions. People have no context for what those numbers mean. They don't connect to anything that people can relate to.
Well, they might just think about weather, like one day being, you know, 25 degrees versus 27 degrees. It sounds like an incredibly trivial difference.
Well, that was my next point, is they're very small numbers. You know, they sound tiny. They sound totally insignificant. So the challenge for scientists really is how to make them meaningful. When you talk about sea level rise of 1 meter, people have no idea what that means. First of all, because it's metric. I mean, the public, they don't use metric in the United States. They don't. But even if you say 3 feet, they still have no concept of what that means because they don't understand that the shoreline can move in 2,000 to 10,000 feet inland for every 1 foot of sea level rise if the land is flat. Unless you give them that and unless you show them what it means, then those numbers, and especially because they're so small, they're meaningless to the public. Another good example along these lines, we know sea level's already risen by about a foot along the New York City coast and by more than a foot at New Orleans. So when a major storm like Katrina comes in, that extra foot of sea level rise on top of the storm surge could mean that the levees are overtopped. It's the straw that breaks the camel's back. And in a storm like Sandy, that extra foot on top of the 12-foot, you know, storm surge to make it 13 foot could mean the flooding of the subways as it did. So you give people those kinds of concrete ways of understanding what that 1 foot can mean or what that 1.5 degrees can mean. You know, you might say that, well, with 1.5 degrees beyond that, we may lose most of the coral reefs in the world. You know, you make it more concrete for them. Just the numbers by itself, not going to be very helpful.
For this issue of 1.5 versus 2, would it make sense to say, or to argue it by analogy or story, as you said, something like, we're talking about taking a city like Moscow and making its climate like the climate of Washington, D.C. versus the climate of Dallas, Texas.
Yes, I think that's very helpful. It's something we actually did in the National Climate Assessment, where we showed the difference of two scenarios, and we showed a particular state, and it would be like the state picked up and moved south. And it's going to move south in either case, but how much south, farther south, is it going to move? And that depends on our choice. That depends on the emission scenario. And so, you know, when Don Wobbles first developed this for Illinois, he was going to talk to his Illinois legislators, and he wanted to show them what the climate of Illinois would be like under different scenarios. And he said, you know, one thing people in Illinois know is they don't want to be living in Texas. And if you can show them that under a higher emission scenario, Illinois is like Texas, that's not going to be a positive thing for them. There are ways of doing the math that works, but it takes some forethought. Don't expect people to do math in their heads. Do calculations for them. Use units that are familiar to them. And always put it in a context that they can relate to.
Let's say that you want to tell a story about the changes in extreme precipitation, perhaps associated with 1.5 versus 2.0. But you also are aware of the range of possibilities that are associated with extremes in the current climate itself. So if you talk about changes in extreme precipitation between those two possible worlds, there is probably a shift in the distribution of these events, but there's also going to be a huge amount of overlap in their statistical distributions. So for something like that, for an event that's hard to predict, even in the current climate, for essentially all climate models, what do you think is an effective story to develop when you want to distinguish between these two possible worlds and the discussion of hope?
So there's a couple of things I would say. One is, I would probably use heat waves instead of heavy downpours in that case, because I think that the story's a lot more clear with heat waves. And we can say that, you know, a heat wave like the one that killed tens of thousands of people in Europe some years ago is now four times more likely because of human-caused climate change. And this recent developments in the science of extreme event attribution are very helpful in quantifying those kinds of changes. And telling people that a summer now that feels like the hottest summer we've ever had is going to be the norm 20 or 30 years from now. Mm-hmm. Every summer is going to be that hot. Or the fact that we now have in a particular city, say 5 or 10 days a year over a certain threshold, say over 95 degrees. But in the future, we're going to have 60 days over that threshold. It's going to be two straight months of the hottest days that you can feel. And the implications of that for public health and, you know, people working outside and kidney disease and all kinds of problems, that's making it concrete for people. That's putting into a context that makes some sense and not just throwing numbers at them that have no meaning. I think that's the way that I would talk about it. But I'd always present it as a choice. It's not like this is what's going to happen and there's nothing we can do about it. It's under a lower emission scenario where we get things under control, then we might see twice as many days. Instead of 5 days, we might have 10 days over 95. But if we continue on the current course of increasing emissions, we're looking at the 60-day picture. So your choice is between a little more and a lot more. And a little more we can adapt to and deal with. A lot more is going to be devastating.
You've also thought and talked a lot about the costs of climate change mitigation. But of course, the other way that you talk about this is in terms of the opportunities of climate change mitigation. And I feel like that part of the discussion is actively being combated in, you know, sort of some sectors of society. Let's say we went down the 1.5 pathway to try and have this aggressive drawdown of atmospheric CO2. There would be loss of some jobs and opportunities in the fossil fuel sector, but also the emergence of this vast new industry that is already exploding, as you talked about, in alternative energies. What needs to happen to bring that point more forward in the debate about the opportunities that arise if you go down an aggressive drawdown or aggressive reduction in emissions?
It's something that I've been talking about a lot. We have always said that the story of climate change is both the threat and the opportunity, but I think we've overly focused on the threat and under-focused on the opportunity. So I would like to see us shift that focus now and talk much more about the opportunities, because the opportunities are enormous, and every analysis that's ever been done shows that it will make society more money economically to develop the clean energy economy of the future, that you get more jobs in energy efficiency and wind and solar and so on than you do from the dirty fuels of the past. So clean energy is something that everyone likes. And I said, you know, I also like to look at polling and data. And one of the things that we see is that across the country, everybody likes clean energy. Everybody's in support of, not everybody, but the vast majority, 80, 85, 90% across the board, even people who don't accept that climate change is real, caused by humans or any of that, they still like clean energy. So clean energy is a sweet spot where everybody agrees and where there are tremendous opportunities for economic growth and economic development. And so sometimes when people want to argue with me about climate change, I say, so do you want to sell solar panels to the Chinese or do you want to buy them from them? That's basically the question for you to ask yourself. And there really are tremendous opportunities. Energy efficiency is such a great thing because it saves money and it improves the bottom line, right? If you're spending less on energy, you have more to spend on other things. Energy efficiency, clean energy, those are the opportunities of the future. And I think we need to spend a lot more time talking about them. We need to point people to resources to show that they're possible. The Deep Decarbonization Pathways Project is a wonderful project. They have a great website. Climate Interactive has a great website that shows us the different choices that we face. Mark Jacobson's work at Stanford about wind, water, and sun powering the world, and with his specific plans for each state and various countries. There's a lot of good news out there, both on what's already happening and what might happen in the future if we do the right things and make the right choices. Now, you know, you mentioned whether it's feasible to stabilize at 1.5 C. And I think maybe one of the reasons why some people say it's not feasible is because they're looking at projections that are based on old rules. They're old rules of how technologies develop and are implemented. But maybe if we really get serious about this, we can change those rules. This implementation can take place much faster than we ever thought it could. I mean, as it is, the prices have come down much faster than anybody predicted they would. The change is happening, and it's happening much more quickly than we anticipated.
You're talking about this possible breaking down of the historical linkage between emissions and economic growth.
Absolutely. I mean, we've already seen it. You know, historically, we've always seen those two things go together, and they've been historically going up since the Industrial Revolution. But for the last 2 years, emissions have flatlined while economic growth has continued. So we may be finally seeing that decoupling. We've only had it for 2 years now. We got to wait and see if it's going to be a longer term trend. But I think the advent of so much renewable energy being deployed may really be a decoupling of those two things. And so maybe the old rules won't apply. That's what we need to believe that we can, and then we need to do it as fast as we can. You know, on the cost issue, if you think that making these changes is going to be expensive, try not making them. If you think that redoing our energy system is too expensive, let's see what happens if we don't. Want to see that. It's going to be a disaster. The costs of climate change impacts are enormous. I think we don't want to go down that road, and I think we don't have to, especially because there are so many other benefits. I think the opportunity is huge, and I think that's really the story we need to be telling, that the future lies in our hands and the benefits of taking really strong action are so tremendous that there's just absolutely no reason not to do it.
Susan Joy Hassel from Climate Communication is a voice for hope on climate change and clear communication. Susan, thank you so much for the chat.
You're most welcome. I've enjoyed it.
That was my interview with Susan Joy Hassel from Climate Communication. Susan's website again is climatecommunication.org, and it's a fantastic resource for all manner of climate communication. The show notes are available at forecastpod.org, including all of the previous 24 episodes. You can reach me through Twitter. I'm at MWClimateSci, or through email, forecastpod@gmail.com. If you'd like to subscribe to the show to get the shows immediately after they're released, you can subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. Love to get comments, feedback, or reviews on any of those platforms. Thanks for listening.